Hello, this is Lisa Mullins, anchor of PRI's The World. The hardest thing about preparing this week's podcast was knowing just when to publish it, when to hit that button. The story coming out of Egypt seems to be moving by the minute. In the newsroom, we have been doing interviews, reporters have been filing their stories, editors have been poring over the scripts, and then, just like that, the story morphs. But here's why I wanted to focus on Egypt just the same, because it's not often that we witness a watershed event, watch it as it unfolds, and know at that moment that our world is being transformed. The protests happening in Egypt are rocking the political landscape of our times. So is President Hosni Mubarak's response to them. He's never had to face the voice of the people like this en masse in his nearly 30 years in power. And the Egyptian people themselves, they have never mustered the collective will or accrued the power to make him even consider relinquishing the presidency. So there are two aspects of this story I kept wondering about. Both of them concern Islam. What role has the religion played in emboldening the anti-government protesters? And what role might Islam have in a future government in Egypt if and when the secular president, Hosni Mubarak, finally does say goodbye? President Mubarak said in his landmark speech this week, "We're living in difficult times." That's for sure. But one strongman's difficult time is an opponent's opportunity. Mubarak has many opponents. The best organized is the Muslim Brotherhood, which Mubarak has banned. Kamal El-Halbawi is the former official spokesman for the Muslim Brotherhood in the West. He says that the Brotherhood wants for Egypt what the protesters want.
Freedom, decent living, end of dictatorship, and end of stupid autocratic regimes.
El-Halbawi says that he looks to the day the Egyptian people will have freedoms Americans have. But if the Muslim Brotherhood or any other group fueled by religion gains popular support in the coming months, can religious allegiance coexist with democracy? I put the question to Noah Feldman, Bemis professor at Harvard Law School.
The Muslim Brotherhood, which is an organization with both political, social, and religious values and ideals, expresses itself publicly on its website, in its literature, across the board, as committed simultaneously to democracy and to Islam. And the political movements that will emerge in Egypt associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, if there is greater democratization, we're of course assuming that there isn't a successful crackdown and that we do actually have some democratization. But if that does happen, it will be a simultaneously democratic and Muslim political party that will emerge, in my opinion, as the most likely to win a great number of votes. And this is not simply true in Egypt. It's been true everywhere in the Arabic-speaking world where there have been even slightly free elections, that Islamic Democrats have done extremely well.
Can you describe how the Muslim Brotherhood embraces or doesn't embrace Sharia law, or what we think of as the harshest form of Islamic law?
Well, first a clarification. Sharia is a term that generally refers to Islamic law with an aspiration to justice and to fairness. There is a component of Sharia that has to do with criminal punishments that is perceived in the West and by many Muslims, as a matter of fact, as harsh if it were applied in the most literal sense. But in most places in the Muslim world where Sharia is applied, it's not applied in that harsh way. The position of the Brotherhood is that there should be a general enforcement of a provision that's already in the Egyptian constitution saying that the Sharia and Islam shall be the source of law. And that is, as I say, already the case in Egypt. And so they're not calling for a total Islamization of society. They also believe that democracy is perfectly compatible with Islam.
Do you believe that?
I certainly believe that there are plenty of versions of Islam that are compatible with plenty of versions of democracy. Neither term is an exact one, has an exact meaning that you can look up in a different dictionary and be absolutely certain as to what it means, because people differ about it. People disagree about what democracy is, and people disagree about what Islam means. And there are certainly versions that overlap. And then there are versions that don't overlap with each other. So it's very much in the hands of the people who are making the decisions, whether it's in the public or in the government.
And how about in terms of Sharia law as we might see it potentially? And again, this is looking into a crystal ball, which could be fuzzy, but if the Muslim Brotherhood were to take over, would that form potentially of Sharia law be consistent with democracy, regardless of what the website says?
Yes, it's possible. The Iraqi constitution, which is drafted by people with not identical but very similar views, specifically guarantees that no law can be incompatible with Islam, and it specifically guarantees that no law can be incompatible with democracy, and it says those things in the exact same sentence. And so the people who drafted that document believe that it is possible for Sharia and for democracy to be consistent. And then it remains to be worked out in practice.
And that's a whole other question, says Noah Feldman. I sat down with Feldman at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, where Monica Duffy Toft teaches public policy. I asked both Toft and Feldman, what's fueling the anti-government protesters to begin with? In other words, is this a religious event, an Islamic movement, or is it a political one? Here's what Monica Toft said.
Well, I think right now it's largely a political event, and it's largely about development and the distribution of goods and services in the society. People do not believe that the government is actually serving them, and so they're taking to the streets in order to voice their concerns that this government they see is largely corrupt, and they want change. So in my opinion, at this point, it's largely a political series of demonstrations and perhaps a revolution.
And Noah, would you agree with that?
I agree with Monica that at the moment it's largely political, driven by a sense of injustice, which includes corruption and failure to deliver services. It's also a political concern with succession in the country, with the concern that President Mubarak would just hand off the country to his son and there would be another 30 or 40 years of the same. I do believe that in a future phase, religion will enter into the question via politics, because as soon as there are elections, and that may not be for a long time, but as soon as there are elections in the country, the very great likelihood is that Islamic political parties that are committed to democracy and to Islam are very likely to be among the very highest vote getters.
Are you putting those in opposition to each other, those who are committed to democracy and those who are committed to Islam, or are you saying they're overlapping?
To the contrary, the Muslim Brotherhood, which is an organization with both political, social, and religious values and ideals, expresses itself publicly on its website, in its literature, across the board, as committed simultaneously to democracy and to Islam. And the political movements that will emerge in Egypt associated with the Muslim Brotherhood, if there is greater democratization, we're of course assuming that there isn't a successful crackdown and that we do actually have some democratization. But if that does happen, it will be a simultaneously democratic and Muslim political party that will emerge, in my opinion, as the most likely to win a great number of votes. And this is not simply true in Egypt. It's been true everywhere in the Arabic-speaking world where there have been even slightly free elections, that Islamic Democrats have done extremely well. And the most explicit example of this is the country with the freest democratic elections in the Arab world, which is Iraq. The government that the United States has been working alongside in Iraq since there were elections in Iraq almost 5 years ago now has been an Islamic Democratic government.
So if it can happen in Iraq, it can happen in Egypt, says Noah Feldman. I got another take on the issue of Islam and democracy from a man who's been studying whether the two can coexist.
My name is Robert Hefner. I'm the director of the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs at Boston University.
Robert Hefner says there's not really a strong model for what's happening in Egypt right now.
But the one that comes closest is the process of democratization that took place and political transition in Indonesia back in 1998. Again, a country that's often not thought of as majority Muslim, but it's the largest Muslim majority country in the world now with 255 million people, 90% of them Muslims. And it had had a very, very authoritarian government for 32 years, so almost exactly as long as Mubarak.
This is the Suharto government.
This is the Suharto government. And in there was the Asian financial crisis that began in late 1997, 1998, a bit like what's, you know, the kind of stuff that we've seen impacting bread prices and food prices in many parts of the Arab Middle East. And out of that came a more general pervasive political destabilization, which quite rapidly snowballed into a rather large democracy and opposition movement.
Remind us what happened then. Did you see the kind of public displays that you're seeing right now? I mean, certainly it was without the advent of social media to rally people, to galvanize people, but what was it like?
It was very similar in the sense that there was not a clear leadership, in part because there was a disparate variety of actors involved in the anti-Suharto pro-democracy movement. It included non-Muslims as well as Muslims, but it was, in terms of its basic demographic composition, it was overwhelmingly Muslim. It's arguably the largest Muslim-led democracy movement the world has ever seen, still today, incidentally, because it's just such a large country. But there were a number of things that were similar then. So kind of relatively leaderless, or perhaps more aptly in the Indonesian case, multiple leaders. But a difference was that there had been signs for the better part of about 10 years of growing opposition to Suharto, and there was a much more public intellectual debate raging in Muslim circles about Islam democracy, which had, if you will, again and again come back affirmative, that democracy is what we want, it is compatible with Islam. Egypt's intellectually, not Tunisia, but Egypt intellectually in terms of public intellectuals who think of themselves as observant Muslims, Egypt is a more conservative place and thus cautious on questions like women's rights, democracy, pluralism, non-Muslims. The movement will also accelerate this debate that's been muffled by comparison with Turkey, Iran, even Morocco, where there's been a debate going on all of those countries for many years as to Islam and democracy, with large numbers of Islamic intellectuals saying, yes, this democracy is fully compatible with Islam, equal citizenship for Muslims and non-Muslims, these are compatible. So these debates have been there in Egypt, but the way in which religion is managed, in part by the state, has meant that those more innovative ideas and those more pro-democracy ideas have had less of a public role. So what this means is that you've got a lot of, if you will, disaffected youth who aren't really particularly committed to a kind of comprehensive political formula. They know they want greater freedom. They know they're unhappy with the regime. They know they've been pushed around. They know the police abuse them. But the vision of what they're struggling for may entail some references to freedom and democracy, but it's not been comprehensively articulated, in part because the ability of, public figures, in particular public intellectuals, to articulate that vision in Egypt has been weaker than it's been in many other parts of the Muslim world.
So compare that again, contrast it with Indonesia. I mean, hold that model up against the model of Indonesia where religion entered into the discussion there.
The big difference is that in Indonesia you have these enormous Muslim social welfare organizations. They run hospitals, they have schools. And these are the biggest in the world.
Meaning who runs them?
Muslim-led organizations. So they're like Muslim associations, and they differ somewhat in their complexion and their, if you will, their religious understandings. But the largest of them has 40 million members. The second largest is 25 million. And what's distinctive about Indonesia and striking by contrast with Egypt is that the leaders of both of these organizations since the late 1980s had stated openly and repeatedly that they wanted democratic reform. So it was more than a decade later before the circumstances were such that you had this kind of unraveling of a very, very powerful regime. But once it began to unravel, there was, if you will, this surge of support from leading Muslim organizations. Whereas in Egypt, the leading Muslim organizations, first of all, there's not as much diversity there. And there's certainly not as much a kind of public legacy of discussion and positive, affirmative commitment to the idea of Islam and democracy being compatible.
It's not part of the discussion.
We cannot justify it in Islamic terms. So you have in Egypt, unlike Indonesia, unlike Turkey, in Egypt you had a greater distance between Islamic intellectuals and the public. The public, according to survey polls that we have, was really pretty unambiguously supportive of democracy and wanted democratic reform. But what's striking in Egypt is you didn't have large numbers of, again, Islamically certified intellectuals, to use that phrase, who were out there and saying, yes, this is Islam, democracy, equal rights for women, this is Islam. You had those intellectuals, but they were, relatively speaking, more marginal than they were in Turkey, Iraq, even Morocco, and certainly Indonesia.
And you say this is as a result of the way President Mubarak of Egypt has managed religion, has managed Islam?
It's even more complex than that because it's not just Mubarak. Mubarak probably would have been happy with the profession of a more liberal variety of Islam, not necessarily on regime change, but on questions of women's rights, minority rights, how you treat the 10% of the population who are Christian Copts. Mubarak almost certainly would have liked to have seen a kind of consensus in the established Islamic community on these issues, but he couldn't get it. And he couldn't get it in part because there was a process, again, relatively speaking, of conservativization of Islamic thought from about the 1980s to the 2000s.
Give me an example.
Well, the idea that there were the Muslim Brotherhood's a complex organization. It has a pro-democracy wing. It has a wing that's, if you will, like these groups that I'm talking about in Turkey, Indonesia, Morocco. But they've not been able to capture the helm of this organization, in part because the organization is banned. There's good difficulties that they face that prevent kind of public debate and indeed can discourage it because you don't want to compromise your organization when you're the subject of repression. In Tunisia, the Islamic intellectuals that we now refer to as moderate Islamists, Rashid Ghannouchi, who just returned to Tunisia a few days ago, this is a man who has long since internalized and promoted the idea in a very substantive way, not in a kind of crudely instrumental way, but promoted the idea that Islam and democracy in a modern substantive sense are compatible. You have such figures in Egypt, but they're not the dominant leaders, the dominant figures in the Muslim intellectual community.
Okay, so the question then is, will they, as this goes on, potentially become the dominant figures in the discussion? Is it inevitable, for instance, as the protests go on, that the question will not just be democracy, but democracy in light of majority Muslim country?
I think what's going to happen is that the process of regime change, if indeed it does move forward, is going to have an extraordinary effect on the Muslim Brotherhood itself, which is some 20 million strong. It is the largest Muslim mass-based organization. It's going to accelerate this debate within Muslim Brotherhood circles in a way that I think, under most circumstances, will be favorable to a relatively more democratic interpretation of how Muslims should conduct their political affairs. In other words, I think this regime change, if it takes place, is actually going to boost the fortunes of the reformist faction of the Muslim Brotherhood. But there's no question that there will be debates, and debates which will in some ways go back to basics in a way that in Tunisia, in Indonesia, in Turkey, and I think to some degree, even in Iraq, you haven't had to go back to basics to the same degree.
Yeah, basics meaning what Islam stands for?
And whether Islam is compatible with democracy, and if it is compatible with democracy, what does that democracy look like with regards to, in particular, to the three hot-button issues in Muslim society, that is the status of women, the status of religious minorities, non-Muslims, and most vexingly of all, the status of Muslims who profess a variety of Islam, which is at cross currents to that of the majority.
Do you have, just final question for you, and you've studied this at length, but do you have any doubt that in majority Muslim countries, Islam and democracy can coexist?
No, I'm quite confident. I think the history shows us already, and it's not a matter of looking to the future, it's looking to what's actually taking place, that the compatibility of Islam and democracy has been proven a possibility. It is already a widespread possibility outside of the Arab majority countries. I've cited some very basic information on democracy in Muslim majority countries, and it turns out that once you go outside of the Muslim world, the 20% of the Muslim world that is Arab to the 80% that is not, actually this is one of the better performing areas in terms of in the global south, as we say, in terms of democratic performance, specifically as regards to the holding of open and competitive elections. So yes, I'm fully confident. Indeed, I think history shows already that this compatibility is possible. This doesn't mean that in every Muslim majority country that experiences a regime change, the transition is going to be easy or always successful.
But Robert Hefner has hope. Where from? Well, the people who started this movement in Egypt to begin with, young people who have never known democracy but have known faith.
I think one of the most interesting and moving of things for me when I look to Egypt is the faith of these largely disorganized youth who are active in some of the protests. These are youth who are probably not associated, most of them, with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're pious, but they're not affiliated. They just are people who think they want to be good Muslims. And in their actions, when they pray in the street in front of the police or in front of army tanks, they're sending a clear message as to how what they think about the compatibility of Islam and democracy, Islam and freedom. And I cannot overemphasize how powerful an image this is going to be and is already across the Muslim world. It's a beautiful and moving testimony to an absolutely vital political change.
Robert Heffner directs the Institute on Culture, Religion, and World Affairs at Boston University. Because the political story is never the whole story, I want a podcast in the near future about real life in Egypt, especially in Cairo and Luxor, from a trip I took there a while back. You're going to hear some of that in our radio program as well, so please stay tuned. In the meantime, even now as I record this piece, things are still changing in Egypt, and we are left hoping that the violence that's erupted won't erase that optimism Robert Heffner talked about a minute ago and the buoyant hopes of a young generation in an ancient land. Thank you, as always, for listening.